Okay, this is now the start of the third disc on the series about how to identify and handle wicked people, and it's talk 11 in that series. And we're continuing looking at the theme of deception and deceivers. So, a new point now under that heading, which is this: don't allow your wish to avoid engaging in gossip to prevent you from listening to people and then evaluating and checking what they say, what they allege. Now, the point is, it's obviously right that you should avoid the sin of gossip, because the Bible clearly forbids us to gossip or to slander other people, so we know we can't do that. And in James 4:11 it says, "Do not speak evil against one another, brethren. He that speaks evil against a brother or judges his brother speaks evil against the law and judges the law." And so we're not to speak badly against each other or to slander each other. But the prohibition against gossip or slander, it presents no difficulty for the wicked, because they pay no attention to it anyway, and therefore it doesn't limit their actions. Even in churches, they just carry on regardless. So it's only sincere people and godly people, the kind of people who earnestly want to obey God, who pay any attention to the command to avoid engaging in gossip. And so the therefore we need to look at this more closely, and it's important that to distinguish the sin of gossip, which is a sin, from merely hearing, evaluating and checking what other people say. So the former, gossip, is sin, but the latter, hearing and checking and evaluating, is not sin. Or at least it's not necessarily. And so there are people, and I used to be one, who are so earnest, so sincere about not gossiping, they won't even let themselves hear negative or accusing things that are being said about others. And because they think, if I even listen to it, that is gossip. Now, I would want to put it to you that that's a mistake. And if you take that view and take it that far, it will prevent you from hearing things that you really need to hear. And let me tell you an example of this. There was a friend of mine, I'm giving him the name Martin, and he once tried to warn me about this church leader that I've called Rick, that I've mentioned already. Now, Rick had become corrupt and carnal in a number of ways, and elsewhere in book 1 and in book 6 I describe some of the things he did. And this is the point: for about 5 years before I discovered for myself that Rick was a liar and a manipulator, Martin had tried to warn me about him. He tried to warn me of those very things, but I refused even to let him finish what he wanted to say. I remember that one particular night, and he tried to tell me, and I just stopped him. And I just said, I just cut him, I said, no, don't say any more. And I felt at that time that even hearing him would be gossip, so I just gently corrected Martin and urged him not to make any accusations against Rick, or even to criticise Rick to me. And I said to him, I remember saying it, we should do all we can to support Rick, to protect his reputation. And then I remember saying to Martin, the devil would dearly love to see us tearing Rick down, and when we ought to be building him up. Now, that was how I spoke at the time, and there was some sense in that and some truth in what I was saying. But just because you've got some sense and some truth in what you're saying doesn't make what you're saying right. You can still be very wrong. And my problem was that I had a wrong definition of gossip, and I was seriously misunderstanding what God did and didn't want us to do. And when I stopped Martin, I just sort of stopped him in mid-sentence. He didn't argue with me. He just let the subject drop, and it was never mentioned again between us for 5 years. He said nothing about it anymore. But during those 5 years, I had a number of eye-opening experiences of my own, and I'd gradually began to make discoveries for myself. And eventually I realised for myself that Rick was carnal and dishonest, that he was causing damage to God's people. And in the latter part of that 5-year stretch, for about 2 years or so, increasingly, I was trying to tackle Rick and trying to urge him to repent and change, but of course he wouldn't. I had every right to do that. I was the chairman of the trustees of the church, and I was a member of the church as well. But I got nowhere, and Rick just blocked me and dodged me at every turn. He also told blatant lies to me and about me, and he was doing it all to avoid being held accountable. And it was only at this stage, after I've been trying in vain to tackle Rick, that I eventually rang Martin up. I remembered what he'd said all those years ago, and I rang him up belatedly and said, "Do you remember that time 5 years ago when you tried to warn me about Rick?" I said, "Could you tell me now what it was that you were trying to tell me back then?" So Martin then told me a long list of problems and wrongdoings about which he himself had tried to tackle Rick and got nowhere. And likewise, he'd got nowhere. That's why he left the church years before. And I was amazed by how remarkably similar his experiences were to mine. And it showed that Rick was wicked and had already been wicked for years without me realising it. And I remember feeling so frustrated. If only I'd listened to Martin 5 years earlier, I could have avoided a ton of stress and conflict. But instead, for three or more years I'd been oblivious, and then for about 2 years I'd tried to tackle Rick, got nowhere. And if only I'd listened. But I'd naively treated Rick as if he simply needed help and advice, when actually he needed to be exposed and resisted. So I had meant well by refusing to listen to what I thought was gossip, and I was sincere, but I was still mistaken. And the mere fact that you're sincere and mean well does not mean that you can never be mistaken, or that you can never do goofy, foolish, unwise things. You can be entirely sincere, but very, very unwise in the way you act. And the point was, I'd failed to see the difference between engaging in gossip and merely listening to people. The one is sin, the other is not. Not necessarily, anyway. And I denied myself the chance to learn vital things about Rick which I desperately needed to learn. And that was, of course, a naive and misguided approach to take. And God wasn't pleased with my refusing to listen to Martin, except possibly that he liked the sincerity of my motives. But my motives being sincere is not enough. If you want to deal with the wicked, you must have more than just sincere motives. You must also have wisdom. Lots and lots of naive people are very sincere, but that doesn't protect them from the wicked. So my policy of refusing to listen to any accusation at all against a leader, before even knowing what it was that was going to be said, was wrong and unwise, and I would urge people not to make the same mistake I made. So here's another point. Pay attention to the smallest amounts or fragments of evidence about someone's character. And open your eyes and ask many more questions as soon as you begin to see a sense that something might be wrong. Now, this is the point. It's unlikely that you'll ever be given any evidence about another person's character that is totally clear, complete, absolutely unmistakable. At any rate, you won't get it all in one go or all at the beginning. Most of the time in real life, the evidence that you get, it comes in small, incomplete, and even contradictory little fragments. You have to piece it together like the bits of a broken vase. You have to piece it together like a jigsaw puzzle. And that's regrettable, but it is the way it is. And there's no use expecting it to be otherwise, because it won't be. And so therefore, if you'll only listen to people who can give you absolute proof, comprehensive, unmistakable evidence, you'll never get anywhere, because most of the evidence you'll ever get will be in the form of small clues and puzzling little inconsistencies, little pieces of a jigsaw. You're not going to get very many people walking up to you with a completed jigsaw puzzle and saying, look at this entire and completely filled in jigsaw puzzle that I have put together, and now I wish to show it to you. It's not going to happen like that. You'll just come across little bits, and you've got to, when you find a little bit, a little clue, a little strange thing, little suspicious little incident, strange little incongruity or inconsistency or anomaly, you have to then be willing to pay attention to it. Because if you won't pay attention to the little things, you're never going to get started on your inquiries. And if you never get started on your inquiries, you'll never finish your inquiries. And if you never finish your inquiries, you'll never come to any proper conclusions. And so you only get to be able to make those kind of conclusions by starting to listen to the little things that happen in your life that don't quite ring true. And so, of course, the full picture, the real conclusion, will only emerge later when you've completed your inquiries, not while you're still doing them, and certainly not before you even begin them. So you therefore can't expect and mustn't expect completeness, consistency and total clarity at the outset as a sort of precondition for being willing to listen to anything or being willing to make any inquiries. That's an unreasonable precondition to apply, and you mustn't apply it. So it's essential therefore that you take note of the little clues when they arise. Don't ignore them. Don't think, well, this is incomplete or it doesn't prove anything, therefore I'm not going to listen to it at all. How could it be that one piece of evidence will prove anything? That's not the way it works. Usually evidence proves something when it's put together with other pieces of evidence, and in conjunction with the other pieces of evidence, the total package of evidence proves something. And that's the way it is. So you mustn't expect of each piece of evidence that it must in itself prove something, because that's not the way it works. You put all your pieces of evidence together, and together they may or may not prove something. So the thing is, therefore, when something unusual happens, like I call it pulling on a loose thread from a cardigan, once you pull on that loose bit of wool sticking out, it's amazing how things begin to happen, unravel, other things come out, and you'd be surprised how much information will come to light. But it won't come if you don't actively look for it. And so one way that this can arise is sometimes a person wants to warn you about a problem which they know you're not aware of. But when that's the case, it can be very difficult for that person. They can feel very vulnerable, and with good reason, because it could cost them a lot if they go out on a limb to warn you, only to find that you ignore them or don't believe them, or even if you resent them for telling you. Because the thing is, most people don't like receiving bad news. They don't like being alerted to a problem which they then have got to deal with. And also, a common response to being told bad news is to shoot the messenger. So therefore, people who want to raise a concern with you, especially if you're a boss, if you're a senior person or a leader, the person raising the concern, they may be left alone afterwards to deal with the reprisals from the wrongdoers about whom he's given evidence or made an allegation. And that could involve bullying or victimization or even the loss of their job if the others get to know what he said about them. Therefore, you need to realise, especially if you're in a position of power or leadership, that people will not come straight out with a clear, unambiguous, emphatic, unmistakable warning and tell you exactly what they know. They just won't do that. People won't often do that. What they'll do, they need to sound you out first to find out what you already know about the wrongdoer, and importantly, what you think of the wrongdoer. So they won't just come and give you complete evidence about the wrongdoer, and you mustn't therefore expect it or make that a precondition to being willing to listen to them, that they give you complete evidence right away at the very beginning. That's not the way that people do it. And so therefore, what people will often do is start a conversation in which they raise a mild concern indirectly or through little hints, or it could even be done in a jocular tone. And people do it like that on purpose, so they can back off if it isn't well received, if you're not open to it or if you're hostile to it. They can pretend they didn't mean anything by it. And so they're doing it as a test. They're sounding you out. They need to find out whether you're open-minded or whether you're likely to be defensive or even resentful about what they're trying to tell you. And they will fear that you could even be supportive of the wrongdoer, especially if you're a boss or a leader. So if you therefore immediately defend the person that they're trying to warn you about, they'll clam up, and then you'll never get to hear the rest of the story, because you'll have scared them off before they ever really got going, while they were just dropping hints. They were still at the hint dropping stage. They were trying to test your allegiances and who are you loyal to. Now let me give you an example of how this can work. There was a lady I once employed, and her name, we'll call her Caroline, and she came to work as a secretary at my law firm. And about 1 week later, she wanted to leave. She put her notice in to leave. I was surprised by this. I questioned her, and she began very nervously to raise some concerns. But she was obviously agitated and unsure what to say and what not to say, and she was very reluctant to speak. And she spoke in a nervous, cryptic way, as if she was dancing around to see how I would react. And then, after a little while, she said that her current concern was, she said, speech marks, it's about someone close to you, end speech marks. And that's what I got out of her. She was skirting around the topic anxiously, but she wouldn't spell out what she was trying to say. And I learned later that she was actually trying to warn me about my PA called Julie, that I've already mentioned in previous talks. And so the point is, in less than a week, Caroline had already seen through Julie and recognised her falseness and her controlling, manipulative nature. And she was trying to drop hints to me as a boss about it, hoping I'd pick up the hints. She was hoping I'd be receptive. And if I had been receptive, she would have opened up more and been more explicit. But Caroline could see that I had no idea what she was talking about and no idea how sinister and manipulative Julie was. So when she could see that I had no idea what was going on, she realised that she was putting herself at risk by being too open. So she began to back off and said no more. And I think one of the reasons she did is because I immediately began to reassure her that Julie was a very nice person, and so on. And she gave up because she could see that I was closed-minded and unable to see what she had seen, even in her first week. Now, in fairness to me, it wasn't just lowness of IQ that was the problem here. The difficulty was that she had a different vantage point from me. She was looking at Julie from underneath as a junior employee, and her perspective and also what she was allowed to see was very different from what I could see. She, in many ways, she had a much clearer view of Julie than I did, because she was looking at her from underneath as a colleague or as a junior colleague. I was only ever seeing Julie from above as a boss, and from that angle Julie looked totally different. She looked completely well behaved and absolutely impeccable, never put a foot wrong in front of me, you see. Well, cats mice don't play when cats are there, do they? So whenever I was there, there never seemed to be any mice. But of course, as soon as I left the room, the mice came out. That's the point. And that's what many bosses don't realise. You know, the mice are looking to see whether the cat is there. That's the whole point. And so the mice would come out when Caroline was there, but the mice wouldn't come out when I was there. So therefore, she gets to see more mice than I ever get to see. And that's the way it works, that's the way it will always work. And so you need to just know it. So that's why she was able to see things about Julie that I couldn't see. And so she saw the reality, and I only saw the illusion, the pretense, the keeping up appearances, as Julie acted out a part. So the thing with this, it's difficult to know how to put into words where the boundary is for every single occasion and for every situation, to know how to achieve balance. Because it's wrong to be unwilling to hear any criticism at all, or look at any little clue of about a person on the one hand, because of your reluctance to engage in gossip, just reverting to that point. But on the other hand, it's also wrong to believe and act upon every allegation that anyone ever makes, such that innocent people's reputations are harmed. So those are two extreme ends of a spectrum. You know, refusing to hear a word said about anyone on the one hand, or immediately believing and acting upon everything anyone ever says. You know, those are the North Pole and South Pole of these two, the two ends of the spectrum. So the right approach in relation to being told something is to be willing to listen and investigate from the outset, but not to believe or act upon anything until you have all the facts and have verified them. So therefore, when people raise complaints or make accusations, as Caroline was tentatively trying to do, you need to pay attention, show empathy, be sympathetic, don't ignore or dismiss anything they say. Also, hear the person out fully, right to the very end, and take all their comments seriously. And don't say anything to reassure them about the person they're complaining about, or to defend the person they're complaining about. That's a really bad idea, and it's premature and inappropriate at that stage to be doing it, because you don't know. I mean, you're reassuring, you don't even know why you're reassuring. You're not even listened to the person yet. You've not even checked it out yet. How do you know that you should be reassuring them? They're trying to warn you. So what are you doing reassuring a person who's trying to warn you? So don't reassure people until you've done your investigation. And so, moreover, if you do any of those things, if you reassure or try to defend the accused person before the witness has completely finished telling the story, they will conclude that you're not really listening to them. Even worse, they'll think you don't believe them, or that you're resistant to their point. So what you have to do, listen sympathetically, openly, to the very end, and don't form any conclusions whatsoever in any direction at that stage, and don't make any assumptions as to what the informant's motives might be. You can find that out later as you go along, as part of the investigatory process. There's plenty of time for that, to check out whether the complainant is genuine. You don't want to be forming a view on that just at the beginning. So wait until the conversation's over, when you've fully heard them, and you've proved to them that you really are listening to them open-mindedly. And only then should you even consider beginning to answer them. Preferably not even then. Don't give any response even then, because your understanding of the real position can change dramatically during the investigation. So if you start answering the person immediately after they've raised the complaint, whatever it's about, bullying or deception or someone stealing things or someone's fiddling something or something's happening that shouldn't be happening, and there you are, you've just been introduced to the facts, and there you are forming conclusions. You see, it's just totally premature at this point. So don't say anything to defend the person or to form a conclusion at all. Because if you do, it implies that you're prejudiced in favour of that person, or whoever that is, or that department, or that whatever. And it even implies that you have a closed mind. And if you give that impression, it will put the witness off saying anything else. Because remember, they're already nervous. The person coming to tell you something, and this is not applicable only to bosses, in case you're thinking, yes, but I don't run a law firm, so nobody will ever come and tell me anything. Well, they may not come and tell you in your capacity as the owner of a law firm, admittedly, but they may come and try and tell you something in your capacity as a house group leader, or as a youth group leader, or as a worship leader, or as not even a leader, just a member of a church. They might come and try and tell you something. They might come and try and tell you something precisely because you're not a leader. But if you don't listen to them properly, they won't tell you any more, because they're nervous and they're likely to misunderstand and overreact to the things you say. So saying things that are premature or inappropriate at that stage, that show any kind of prejudice or closed mind, can put them right off, but also it can actually create a closed mind in you, even if you haven't got one to start with. Because the thing is, as you hear yourself defending the person that they're speaking about, you can even start to be persuaded by your own words. And so you can find yourself unconsciously forming a conclusion prematurely, even before the inquiry has begun. And even as you hear your own words by which you reassure the complainant, you can find that your own mind is tending to close automatically, without you even knowing it. And if that happens, then you'll not investigate matters properly with the requisite vigour and thoroughness and openness of mind. And so it also, in taking that approach, increases the chances of you misunderstanding and misconstruing the evidence, because you'll be looking at the case through the lens of your own words, by which you've already declared the person to be innocent that the complaint is being made about, even before you've investigated. And there's another problem here. You've also got to realise that people are so wary of you, and so wary of telling you anything, whether you're a boss or not, especially if you're a boss, that they're so wary that they'll feed you the information in stages. They want to see what you do with the first batch of information before they tell you any more. So don't be too quick to assume that they've finished telling their story, even if they tell you that they finished telling their story. I don't believe it when a person tells me they finished their story. And usually they haven't finished their story. What they really mean, translated into English, is, that's what I'm telling you for now. That's the first batch. I want to see how you'll react and how you'll act and what you'll do with it and how you'll deal with it before I put myself in any further jeopardy by telling you anything else. And if you don't realise that that's what people are thinking, you'll mistakenly think that they've finished telling their story. But the chances are they're still holding back additional information, and probably holding back the most crucial parts of it, until they're absolutely convinced that you can be trusted. Because think about it, why should they think that you can be trusted? This might be a bewildered, frightened secretary, or it could be a frightened, you know, organist in the church, or it could be some kind of distressed person who's being bullied by a house group leader, or you name it, whatever. How do they know whether you can be trusted? How do they know that you're not big friends with that house group leader? You see, they've got to sound you out. And that's what people do, they sound you out until they know whether they can tell you the whole story. Now, if the Caroline story, the episode I spoke of, if that was to happen today, the way I'd handle it would be to immediately reassure her that anything she said would be kept confidential. I wouldn't go and speak to Julie about it, or whoever that she was speaking of, and I would say, I'm just going to use it as the basis for starting a discreet investigation in which I'll say you won't be named or exposed as having said a word. I won't say a word about you, Caroline. I'll just look into it. But at that time I wasn't sensitive enough, I was too naive to realise what was going on or to pick up what Caroline was hinting at. And part of my mistake was I expected her to come out into the open immediately and clearly say what she wanted to say. Now, that might be a reasonable expectation when you're dealing with strong, confident, senior people. So if you're the managing director and the finance director comes up to you and wants to say something, it's perhaps not unreasonable to expect the finance director to have enough confidence to speak up. But even then, it's probably not realistic to expect people to speak up openly and fully, even if they are senior. But it's certainly not reasonable to expect that when they're weak and timid junior people, junior staff, junior church members, young, timid people. They won't come out with it all right at the start, completely explicit, and tell you exactly what they know, exactly why they're saying it, exactly what happened, because they don't know whether they can trust you. So therefore, I missed a helpful early warning sign about Julie, an early warning which would have saved me and the staff a lot of grief if I'd listened to it. If I had been astute enough to pick up what Caroline was hinting at, then I could have found out about Julie at least a year earlier than I did. In the end, I found out by other means. But the point is, the art of it is to find out earlier, by earlier warning signs. Why do you need 6 carbon monoxide detectors to go off before you go and check if there's a problem? Why not check after the first one? You see? So I should have pulled on the woolen thread coming out of the cardigan and found out more, as much as I could, rather than be so complacent about it. Assuming, because of course I assumed, I was acting on what I thought to be the case. I thought Julie was completely reliable and faithful and a very good member of staff. Think about it. Why would I not think that? I'd appointed her to be my PA. Why would I have appointed her to be my PA if I didn't think that? But the thing is, you can't say, here's my current opinion. I will not let any person warn me of something that would appear to contradict my current opinion. No one puts that into words, but that's what you're implicitly saying. I won't allow a person to say a thing that cuts across my current opinion. Well, if you take that approach, you'll always have to carry on having the same opinion, won't you? You've got to be willing to abandon your opinion, your judgment, your assessment of someone or something when the evidence requires you to, or would suggest that you should do so. Anyway, on to another point here, which it sounds like a strange point, but I think is actually more useful and happens more often than you might imagine. And this is this question is, how to tell when a woman is genuinely crying or is just faking it in order to manipulate you or to get you to back off when you're tackling her or when you're conducting an investigation? Now, you might think, well, that's never going to happen to me. I think it may. And you don't have to be this happened to me a fair bit. But I was a boss and was often investigating people. But you don't have to be running a law firm for this to be the case. You could be a house group leader, a church leader. You could be a youth group leader. You could be just a member of a church. You could be anything. It's not only to leaders that things are said or that this is done. So it may sound like an odd piece of advice that I'm going to go into, but it can be useful and it arises more often than you might think. So let's imagine a situation where you've got to perhaps interview a woman either about her misconduct or her incompetence, or maybe she's making an allegation or a complaint about somebody else, or someone has made a complaint about her, or whatever it is. For whatever reason, you may have to question her, and perhaps you want to cross-examine her either in church or at work or wherever. Now, when you're dealing with that woman, you may find that at a certain point in your cross-examination or discussion, she'll start crying. And if so, you've got to work out whether that is genuine or phony. And if your assumption is that all crying is obviously genuine, and you just take that as a, you know, as an absolute rule, then you need to think again, because fake sobbing is routinely used by deceitful women as a manipulative device. And they may want to get you to stop a particular line of questioning because you're getting too close to the truth and they're finding it hard to think of convincing answers. I often found that, because I had quite a quiet interrogating style. I never used to shout at anyone, but I just kept asking questions and pursuing them. And I was kind of pursuing them through left and right, and there they were. And I was following them. And sometimes if they found that I was hard to shake off, out would come the crying as a way of stopping it, because my questioning was a bit too effective. And so they may be wanting also to get you to stop the questioning altogether, or to adjourn for a while. They may want to adjourn in the hope that you'll get distracted and maybe you'll forget about the unanswered question that was hanging in the air when the interview was adjourned, and that when you come back to it, you'll have forgotten about it. Or they may just want to manipulate you into feeling sorry for them so that you'll go easy on them and believe what they say. or they may hope that you'll abandon the investigation or let them off or give them some minor sanctions, such as a warning. Sometimes they just want to adjourn the meeting for a bit so they can gain time to think of invented answers or to tamper with documents or to hide evidence or delete emails or whatever before the meeting resumes. Or they may want to try and intimidate witnesses to get them to amend or withdraw their evidence before the next meeting or hearing. Another reason why people do it is they want to adjourn the meeting for procedural or tactical purposes to get past some qualifying date. And this will make sense in an employment law context, because it might be that just at the moment they don't have the requisite period to bring a tribunal claim, but if they can just hold on for another couple of weeks, they'll have enough evidence, they'll have enough time rather, and they'll then be able to bring a claim. So they need a delay. So there's all sorts of reasons why people will start crying. Not just one reason, lots and lots of reasons why people will do this. Not just in a cross-examination, but just in a meeting or whenever you're dealing with something. So I emphasise that because I don't want people to think that these things are only applicable if you're interrogating somebody in a police station or in an employment tribunal context. It's applicable in all sorts of ways, because people will use this trick on you, you know, in many situations. And so, just taking that last one I was mentioning there about trying to adjourn a procedure so that you get past, the person can get past a qualifying date. Now that might, you might be blind to that sort of trick, but they're not. And I've had people do this. I had a woman called Chloe, I've mentioned her already. And she was a salaried partner in my law firm. And so she did the crying thing. She started crying in an interview. I was questioning her about her misconduct. So she started crying because she could see my evidence was good. And I was putting it to her very calmly but very methodically. And she was weighing up how much evidence I'd got. And when she could see that I'd got a lot of evidence, she started crying, not because she was upset, although probably she was a bit upset, but that wasn't anything to do with it. She started crying because she wanted to adjourn the meeting. So she adjourned the meeting because I was too naive to realise what she was up to. And I naively agreed to adjourn the meeting and we'll come back tomorrow. And of course there was no tomorrow. She then went off sick, saying she was suffering from stress. And she was unable to come back to resume the investigatory hearing. Now this gap in the proceedings went on for exactly 2 months. Now during that time, while she was off on so-called stress, she was on full pay. And then, on the very day when her contractual entitlement to sick pay ran out, and she was no longer going to get any wages for being off sick, she suddenly returned to work. So her stress-related illness went away at the exact moment when the sick pay ended. Now there's a miraculous outcome. And so we then resumed the investigation. We went into a disciplinary hearing after a while, and then I dismissed her for gross misconduct. But her devious trick, the crying routine, followed by going off on sick leave, got her, in the end, 3 months of extra pay, 2 months plus another month, before she was eventually sacked. And she was fully expecting dismissal, because she'd seen all the evidence I'd got. Indeed, that was the very reason why she resorted to those tactics. If she thought her case was good and mine was weak, she wouldn't have needed to. She did it because my case was good and hers was weak. She knew I was going to win, because I'd told her my evidence. I'd already told her, and I'd found out a lot from staff, and I told her about it, told her what evidence I had, because I'd been building a case. So therefore, just returning to this original point now about the crying trick. Sometimes, not always, a woman crying in any kind of meeting like that is fake and it's being contrived to deceive you. I'm not saying it always is the case, I'm saying it sometimes is. Quite often is. Therefore, if a woman does start crying, let me now give you a test that you can use to see whether it's genuine. And to do this, you're going to have to do the very opposite of what that woman, if she's false, is trying to get you to do. So when she starts it, instead of stopping the interview, even for a moment, instead of stopping, even for a second, when it happens, when the crying starts, force yourself to continue your line of questioning and do it without any break, as if nothing had been done, as if nothing had happened. It'll go against all your instincts and your upbringing, because you'll think it's not gentlemanly to ignore some woman crying in front of you. Even so, to carry out this test, you need to make yourself do this, otherwise it won't work. When she starts up crying, just carry on regardless and ask another question, preferably a difficult one, but do it in a calm, dispassionate tone of voice, as if you hadn't even noticed that she's crying. Now, if you do this, then at this point, the woman will probably do one of two very different alternative things. So she might just continue crying uncontrollably and be unable to stop, despite the provocation of your continued questioning and your failure to pay any attention to her crying. Now, if she just carries on regardless, the chances are she's probably genuinely crying and isn't faking it. But there's an alternative. She might instead suddenly stop crying and become hostile or even abusive. And if she does that, you can be quite sure that it was phony from the beginning, because no woman who's genuinely upset and crying is capable of bringing the crying to an immediate stop and displaying some other emotion instead, such as anger, because they can't do an emergency stop, and they're even less capable of suddenly becoming calm so as to answer your questions or put their own questions to you in a resentful tone. So I just don't think they can do it if it's a genuine crying. But in addition to this test, take a close look at the woman's face when she's crying. See whether you see any actual tears in the literal liquid sense being produced by her eyes. If they are, that's an indicator that the crying's likely to be real. But if her face is dry while she's bawling away, and her eyes aren't producing any actual tears, you can be even more certain that she's fake. Now, I first learned this lesson and this test about whether crying is real when I was in an investigatory hearing with a lady, I'll call her Charlotte. And she wanted to be a solicitor, that means a lawyer. And she was doing a fully paid trial year with our firm as what we call a legal clerk, to see how she got on, see how good she was. Now, she was actually a Christian, or she claimed to be one, although I doubt whether she really was saved, because she was so thoroughly dishonest. In fact, it's because of her devious ways and her neglect of files and clients, and because of the lies she'd been telling to cover things up, it was because of all that she was being investigated in the first place. So I didn't have a good opinion of her to begin with. I already considered her to be an unreliable and dishonest witness. So I was partway through an interview with her, in which I've been putting a series of probing questions to her about her neglect of various files. I've just been going through them one after another, the Bloggs file, the Jones file, the Smith file, different files that I was asking her questions about. And she was giving a series of feeble answers that were plainly lies or just dodging the point. And at a certain point, when she could see that it wasn't going well for her, and that I wasn't believing her lies, she could see I wasn't falling for any of it. At that point, she suddenly tried the crying trick. She just started from nowhere, like in the middle of nothing. She just suddenly started crying, bawling. But I felt even the way she did it was odd. Now, the thing is, it was possibly that God prompted me, or maybe I could see through her, but maybe God helped me to see through her. But suddenly, I just had a prompting, or a thought, and I decided to continue my line of questioning as if nothing had happened, and as if she wasn't crying. Okay? I'd never done this before, but I tried it just then. And when I did, this lady, Charlotte, she instantly stopped crying. It was like a car going from 70 miles an hour to a complete stop in less than a yard. And she also looked at me with an expression of surprise and then anger and then resentment in her face. But the point is, the crying had completely gone, all of a sudden, totally stopped. What's more, in a single second, she was able to speak normally again, and she took on a defiant tone, and her face was quite dry, and she started arguing back to me. And that episode with Charlotte taught me a valuable lesson and a good test, which I've since used quite successfully. Because the key point to remember is, a woman who's genuinely crying can't just stop instantly, like a car doing an emergency stop on a dry road, because they're just not wired up that way at the factory. So they're more like a car driving at 70 miles an hour on a wet road, and they have a long stopping distance. So whether you're doing this in a church context or a work context or dealing with some kind of witnesses or whatever it is, or you're dealing with a complaint about someone or by someone, allow yourself to use this little test. It'll improve your discernment and help you to identify some deceivers and manipulators. And you need to also remember this: if a woman is willing to deceive you in this way by pretending to cry, you can rest assured she'll already have been deceiving you in other ways as well, and for a long time. And so it's more significant than it may appear to be just in itself. So that, as with all these tests, they tell you something, but they don't tell you everything. Your job is then to investigate other things as a result of this carbon monoxide detector starting to bleep. Then you need to test what else is wrong. You know, where, what else might be, what other evidence is there? What else might be happening? What else might they be doing? Could there be something else that's going on as well? And usually there is. So another point, a brief point. It's wrong to be sceptical about the Bible. And we looked at that in book 3 about how to study the Bible. But so it's wrong to be sceptical and full of unbelief about the Bible. But it's right and proper to be sceptical about everything and everybody else until the facts are fully known. You shouldn't place your faith or your confidence in people until you know them properly, until the facts are known. And so it's not the same as when you're looking at the Bible, and we would rightly criticize anyone who is skeptical about what the Bible says. They're obviously wrong to be skeptical, but you're right to be skeptical about everything except the Bible. So in virtually every other context in life, a healthy scepticism and a desire to see evidence and to base your conclusions on clear evidence for which there is corroboration, and seeking all that before taking any action, is essential. You must be careful and sceptical and take some convincing before you take action based on things that someone says. So, we're commanded to believe God, but we're not commanded to believe other people or the things they allege. So far from being under any duty to believe people, we're positively told in the Bible not to believe people until what they say is verified by hard evidence, and usually, preferably, from a number of other witnesses or other sources of corroboration of one kind or another. So here's just a few verses I've pulled out that illustrate this. So in Numbers 35:30 it says, "If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness." So you mustn't put them to death on the testimony of one witness. But note, if they've been a witness, what does that mean you've done? It means you've listened to them. So you'll at least listen to the witness. But all that Moses is telling us not to do is not to act on it, not to act on the evidence of one witness. But you will listen to them. Because how can you listen to the second witness until you've listened to the first witness? Do you see? There has to be a first witness, doesn't there? And then in 1 Timothy 5:19, Paul says, "Never admit any charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses." Now note, what does Paul say? Never admit any charge. He doesn't say never listen to any charge. And I've heard people speak as if Paul was saying, you know, never let anybody say a word to you about an elder. Never let anyone even try to make an accusation or say anything. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying never admit a charge. That means not, don't believe it or act upon it. Don't come to the conclusion that the charge is valid and correct. Just listen to it, check it out, investigate it, perhaps even park it and say, that's a strange thing, that allegation has been made, I don't know what the answer is, but I'm going to just park it and see whether anything else comes up in the future. And that's not admitting a charge. You're not saying, I'm convinced about this elder that he's acted wrongly. No. But neither are you saying you're convinced he hasn't. You're just parking it. So you're not going to act upon it or believe it until you've got proof, corroboration of at the requisite level, whatever that might be in the circumstances. And then in 2 Corinthians 13:1, Paul says, this is the third time I'm coming to you. Any charge must be sustained by the evidence of two or three witnesses. See? So he's repeating what the law of Moses says, which is good, sound advice. Okay. So just a little more, and then I think I'll stop this talk. So one final point in this talk. The wicked will often appear to be sweetness and light. This is in the context of identifying the wicked, identifying deceivers. So the wicked will often appear to be sweetness and light, whereas honest people can often seem to be prickly and difficult to handle. And if you aren't aware of this, what you might call an anomaly, you'll often misjudge them. So if you're going to learn to recognize wicked people, you must realize that they will not usually appear to be wicked, at least not to begin with. On the contrary, to the untrained eye, the wicked will often appear to be nicer, to be sweetness and light. They'll appear to be nicer than other people until you learn otherwise. So that's often been the case in my experience. The wicked have seemed to be nicer people at the outset than those other people whom I later discovered were faithful and trustworthy. Now that's partly because the genuine people were not putting on any act. The genuine people just being themselves, whereas the wicked were putting on an act. And so that's something you just need to be aware of, and the concept of putting on an act. And so the ones who are sweetness and light may be putting on an act, and you need to recognize that possibility. The ones who are more difficult, more prickly, well, their prickliness might be something that God would like them to work on. No doubt he would. But we're not talking about prickliness. We're talking about whether people are faithful, genuine, sincere. So this fellow over here, he's more prickly, more difficult to handle perhaps, a bit more assertive, he's a bit more awkward. But it might very well be that he is more honest and more faithful than this person who's sweetness and light to you. So another point is that you must positively expect for there to be phony people in your life who are not what they seem to be. If you're going around thinking that this is a remote contingency that will virtually never happen, or perhaps even never happen, you're going to get things very wrong. So don't look upon it as an extremely improbable outcome, you know, but look upon it as something that's to be fully expected. So if you work with 50 people at your office or factory or shop or whatever, don't ask yourself whether any of them might be phony. The right question would be, probably be, which of them are phony? If you've got 50 colleagues, the chances of none of them being phony are remote. And you must also positively expect to be lied to and for it to happen regularly. That's part of what it is to be realistic about life. So reconcile yourself to the fact that it's your duty to identify those lies and those liars who tell them. And your expectations are crucial, because expectations will either open your mind and assist you in your inquiries, or they will close your mind and make it harder for you to see what's going on, or to respond to events, or respond to warnings, or to react when you hear bleeps from a carbon monoxide detector. So your expectations and your preconceived ideas will have a major bearing upon whether you leap up and run over to see why what the bleeping's about, or whether you saunter over and take the battery out of the carbon monoxide detector because you fully expect that there's no problem. It's your expectations that will have a bearing on that, and you need to get your expectations right, which is that there are going to be frequently occasions where people lie to you, and you must expect that. That doesn't mean that everybody's lying to you, but you must expect that there will be frequently people lying to you. If you don't think that, then you're being almost certainly being unrealistic, unless you work and live in an extremely unusual place, which is by definition unusual. So on that point, I'll end that talk.